king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. Does that sound familiar? Okay, that's pretty much the same thing as the first verse that we have in 1 Chronicles chapter 20 and verse 1. And if I go down to the end of chapter 12 in 2 Samuel, I'll pick it up at verse 26. 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 26. Meanwhile, Joab fought against Rabbah of the Ammonites and captured the royal citadel. Joab then sent messengers to David saying, I have fought against Rabbah and taken its water supply. Now muster the rest of the troops and besiege the city and capture it. Otherwise, I will take the city and it will be named after me. So David mustered the entire army and went to Rabbah and attacked it. Now verse 30, he took the crown from the head of their king. Its weight was a talent of gold and it was set with precious stones. That sounds a whole lot like what we read in 1 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 2, right? David took the head from their king and placed it on his own head, or the crown from their king and placed it on his own head. It was placed on David's head. He took a great quantity of plunder from the city and brought out the people who were there, consigning them to labor with saws and with iron picks and axes, and he made them work at brick making. He did this to all the Ammonite towns, and David and his entire army returned to Jerusalem. And back in 2 Chronicles 20 and verse 3, then David and his entire army returned to Jerusalem. The thing about this that I want us to pay attention to and consider is what falls between 2 Samuel 11:1 and 2 Samuel 12:26, where we pick up the story again of Rabbah and the Ammonites, and meanwhile, what happens in between there? Bathsheba happens in between there, okay? The Chronicles account doesn't talk about that at all. The Chronicles account does not deal with the sins of David. As I mentioned earlier in the week, that's not the point of the Chronicles account. It's not about the sins and the outcomes of the sins. It's about the things that David set in order, because they were needing to set those things in order once again in temple worship and in the liturgy of the priesthood and so on and so forth. But the Samuel account is looking at different things and drawing different kinds of lessons for us than the setting in order of matters relating to the temple and worship and getting all of that established. And so we have in between the beginning of the campaign against the Ammonites and the conclusion of the campaign against the Ammonites, the story of David, Bathsheba, Uriah, and Nathan, and how all of these things, and Joab, of course, being a principal player in here, how all these things played out. And so in verse 26 of 2 Samuel 12, we're taken back to what's going on meanwhile on the grand scheme of things. Meanwhile, Joab is fighting this battle against Rabbah of the Ammonites while David is carrying on in Jerusalem. Now, the reason that I presented that to you the way that I did is because I wanted to think a little bit about that psalm that seems to me to be genuinely connected with the crowning of David after the conquest of the Ammonites and the celebration and the tone in that psalm. Can you imagine David writing a psalm like that when he has just been through the things that he has done and all that's associated with that in connection with Bathsheba? Can you imagine David writing a psalm like that at that point in his life? A psalm of celebration and praise to God, a psalm about the victories God gives and the gifts of God. Well, we know another psalm that David wrote at just that time. It's specifically ascribed to him at just that time in the heading of the psalm, Psalm 51. And let's turn and read that psalm, Psalm 51. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion. Blot out my transgressions, wash away all my iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. Against you, you only, have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are proved right when you speak and justified when you judge. Surely I was sinful at birth. And that's probably not the best way to say that. Surely I was sinful at birth, but it's just emphasizing. I have to add this because of all the other discussion about Calvinism and predestination and so forth this week, that David's just talking about the way he feels about himself. He's not making a doctrinal statement here in any case. Sinful from the time my mother conceived me. Surely you desire truth in the inner parts. You teach me wisdom in the inmost place. Cleanse me with hyssop, and I will be clean. Wash me, and I will be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones you have crushed rejoice. Hide your face from my sins and blot out my iniquity. Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me from your presence or take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. Then I will teach transgressors your way and sinners will turn back to you. Save me from blood guilt, O God, the God who saves me, and my tongue will sing of your righteousness. O Lord, open my lips and my mouth will declare your praise. You do not delight in sacrifice or I would bring it. You do not take pleasure in burnt offerings. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. In your good pleasure, make Zion prosper, build up the walls of Jerusalem. Then there will be righteous sacrifices, whole burnt offerings to delight you. Then bulls will be offered on your altar. Now, what is the whole tone of this psalm? Sorrow, repentance, regret, pleading with God. All right? Can you picture those two psalms that we've just read, Psalm 51 and Psalm 21, being written within perhaps days or at most weeks of one another? Coming from the same hand? Exactly. That is kind of how it was after the child died. I want to go back now and go through the story of David and Bathsheba and notice a few of the details of the story. On the one hand, it bothers me a little bit. It bothered me a little bit when I first looked at that and thought about the connection there with the crowning of David, with the golden crown and the psalm that was written there and the tone of celebration there. And it bothered me a little bit because, you know, I have known people who could go through the motions of religiosity, who could put on all of the appearance of being sanctimonious and holy and righteous when they were deep in sin, when there were horrible things taking place in their life, secret sins that no one knew about. And it perplexed me a little bit, but it doesn't look to me like, as I read that psalm, it doesn't look to me like that's a facade that David is putting on. Rather, it looks to me like in Psalm 51, he is saying, O Lord, please deliver me and let me once again hear praises and experience joy. And in Psalm 21, no matter how shortly after it follows, that is what's happening in David's life, as is also indicated in the way he dealt with the death of his child, the illegitimate child of David and Bathsheba. 2 Samuel chapter 11. We have Joab and the army gone out to war against the Ammonites, and then in verse 2 of chapter 11, one evening David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. What did he do about that? He said, or he sent someone to find out about her. Now, you know, there's an unhappy irony here. It reminds me of Saul and David when David went to kill Goliath. Whose son is that man? There's an unfortunate irony here in the way this story is carried through. The man that David sent to find out about her comes back and says, isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Now, I don't know that we have that we can be absolutely certain about the identity of Bathsheba, but I do want to call your attention to this, the name of her father, Eliam. If we go to the 23rd chapter of 1 Samuel, where we have a listing of some of the heroes that were in David's army, some of the significant characters in David's army, in 2 Samuel chapter 23, verse 34, in the list of the 30 men who had shown great renown, great heroism, we have two particular names that I want to notice. One in verse 34, we have Eliphelet, son of Ahasbai, the Maacathite, and Eliam, son of Ahithophel, the Gilonite. Eliam, the son of Ahithophel, the Gilonite. And then down in verse 39, Uriah the Hittite. These two men were both numbered among the 30, great heroes in the army of David. And I want us to remember that here we have the description of Bathsheba as being the daughter of Eliam. Eliam is the son of Ahithophel. And let's see, I do want to put Bathsheba here so we don't forget this. So we have that as a genealogy for Bathsheba, probably. This is the Eliam that we would expect to be mentioned here, since since this is in the court of David and so on and so forth. But at any rate, we have Ahithophel, the father of Eliam, the father of Bathsheba. We'll come back and revisit that in a little while and see what is probably going on behind the scenes, so to speak, here. It's very likely, if this Eliam is indeed the one that's mentioned here, that there was probably an age gap between Uriah and Bathsheba. Bathsheba was probably quite a bit younger than Uriah, and she certainly was quite a bit younger than David. She was not of the same generation that David was. A beautiful woman, it is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And now that David knows who she is, what does he do? He sends for her. Now, this is really an incredible thing, and we can muse about why he does it. But he is sending for, apparently, the daughter of a man who is his loyal servant and the wife of a man who is his loyal servant. And he is doing that with no good intentions at all. He certainly has no good intentions here. How does a man justify doing something like this? A man who certainly knows better. How does a man justify doing something like this? Your brain isn't necessarily in gear when your hormones are going, but you know, this is not a two-minute process. This is David talks to people, sends people over there, has her brought back. There's a process here that's taking some time and involving some other people.
There are two things I was thinking. First of all, David had more wives, and perhaps because of the numerous wives, his parents maybe be more open to temptation.
Maybe having more than one wife made him more open to temptation rather than the reverse. And several concubines who aren't even named.
The second thing, of course, we forget the effect of kingship. When you're outside of the law, it's a constant temptation without even thinking. And David is a king. And always the fight against that. That's what happened to Saul, the kingship.
All right.
That's what happened to Solomon.
There is the allure of power, being in the position of authority that you can do whatever you want to. And who's going to stop you? All right.
Everybody honors you. Whatever you want, that's open to them.
All right. Jay, go ahead. Right, so there's some risk of being too smug in one's own godliness and some arrogance to go along with that and presuming the generosity of God.
You just talked about how looking at a woman in the lust after adultery, and you mentioned that this time in between David waiting to find out who she was and then waiting for her to come, he could have been lusting the whole time.
All right, the visual experience is certainly a part of this. David has seen her in a way that really attracts him, really draws his interest. Men pursue this all the time in voyeurism and pornography and all kinds of things because there is a male appetite here that is already being excited. Did you have your hand up, Mike?
I think the first chapter of James has an interesting progression. But each one is tempted when by his own evil desire he is dragged away and then after desire has conceived, he gives birth to sin. Then when it's full grown, he goes to death. There's a process going on here that's growing and growing, and David seems to be following that kind of process.
Do you suppose the situation here where David is here in Jerusalem, but Joab in the army is over there at Rabbah, has anything to do with that? What's it have to do with it? Okay, he's not really doing what he has always done, which is going out there and leading the army and participating in the accomplishments and achievements. And I imagine that there is some midlife crisis going on here, if you want to think of it in those terms, that David is feeling a little bit of antipathy about his own position in life. Yes, he's accomplished all this, but, and he's aware of his own limitations and maybe even thinking about his own oncoming mortality. You know, a lot of times when guys are at this 40s to 50s stage in their life, this becomes an absurd factor in their life. Maybe some of that was going on with David too, while he's at home and the army is out in the field without him. Tom. That's what Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 1:10. If I saw it and wanted it, I took it. I had it. And David seems to have experienced a little bit of that kind of thinking here. Did David know better? Oh, clearly David knew better. There's no question about that. People do things even when they know better, though, don't they? Good people, Christian people, followers of God do things even when they know better. And that's what's happening with David here. He knows better. But he starts down, as Michael described, a progression. He looks at something, he sees that he wants it, he goes to take it, and then that leads to yet another step. And the end of the progression that was there in James is death. Well, there's death here too, isn't there, in this story? There is death in this story. Go ahead. Very little. I'm going to say, Dwayne asked what role Bathsheba has in this, and he mentions her bathing where she could be seen. But I'm going to say she has very little, and I'm going to say that because of the way the story is handled and what's said about it, that she has very little responsibility in this. I'm not suggesting she didn't sin. I'm not suggesting she didn't do wrong. But her role in this compared to David's role in this is minimal. Not that she wasn't wrong, but that the great guilt for this sin lies at David's door. I doubt that she was doing anything that was considered inappropriate, and she did not anticipate that David would be in a place to view her. That was a set of circumstances that she had not imagined. I certainly don't think she was trying to present herself where David would notice her and respond to her, but that is indeed what happened. Let's go on into the story a little bit more here. David saw her, David wanted her, David sent messengers to get her, and she came to him. And he slept with her, and there's a reference made to her ritual cleanliness. She had purified herself from uncleanness. And to me, that is just so ironic. Here is this detail of the law, that she is in a place where she is clean, that she is in the monthly cycle in a place where she is clean and a man can lie with her. Well, yeah, her husband. But here is this gross violation of the commandments, the core of the law, the covenant portion of the law that God had given at Mount Sinai. This gross violation of that, and yet we have the note that in terms of the monthly cycle, she was ready for a man to be with her. She had been purified from her uncleanness. And then she went back home. And what happened when she went back home? Go ahead, Susie. It was David on the roof. Yeah. David had a vantage point that came to him because of his position, power, and wealth. And wherever she was bathing, it doesn't say where she was bathing, wherever she was bathing, he was able to observe her. But again, I seriously doubt that she thought anything about that happening, that she realized that that would happen. David sent word to Joab. What did David want? Well, first, before he wants to get rid of Uriah, what's the first message to Joab? Send Uriah home. What's his purpose in sending Uriah home? Cover the sin. Let Uriah go home, be with his wife. Uriah will assume it's his child. Nobody will ever know the difference. Was this true love on David's part with Bathsheba? A lifetime commitment? I can't imagine that they didn't talk to each other.
Wasn't as bad as it was if they thought there was some affinity there, some common ground there.
And you know, I can imagine all kinds of things. I didn't really elaborate on this too much, and I won't because of just time involved, but I can imagine all kinds of things that may have gone through David's mind to make this seem all right, like the fact that Uriah was... maybe his rights don't count so much. And Bathsheba is the daughter of Eliam, the son of Ahithophel, who is of Gilon, who is an Israelite. She is an Israelite woman. However, the very name Uriah, when you've got that A-H ending on a name, what's that tell you? That's the name of God, Yahweh, Jehovah. And his name means Jehovah is light. He has a name, a godly name. Was that a name given to him by the Hittites, or was that a name he took when he converted to be a Jew, a follower of God? He shows more character in this story, and that's intentional that we should see this. He shows more character in this story as a godly man than David does. Because he comes and he holds in esteem the people of Israel, the Ark of the Covenant, the things associated with Israel's faith and Israel's God. And he won't violate those things. He is a man who demonstrates great loyalty. And you know, this is as good a place as any to mention that when you read through the story of David, those people closely associated with David are generally fiercely loyal to him. Joab, in this story, is willing to do things that are absolutely absurd, that a commander of the army should do them, and yet he trusts David. David says to do this, it must be what needs to be done, and Joab will do what David says. He says, send me Uriah the Hittite, and Joab sends him Uriah the Hittite. As you know, in the story, that doesn't work out. Uriah refuses to go home to his wife, even though the king gets him drunk and tells him go home. The king does his best to make Uriah go home to his wife, and Uriah won't go home to his wife because he considers that unprincipled and inappropriate for him to take advantage of the situation. The king called him home, as he thinks, to give a report about the battle and then to have him carry a message back to Joab. And what was in the message the king gave him for Joab? See that he's killed. He carried his own death message back to Joab. And again, the terrible irony of what a man will do when he's trying to cover sin without dealing with it. Jay.
I realize the emphasis of this is on David, but I'd like to compare Bathsheba and her actions with Abigail.
All right.
Abigail was a woman who told David to remember her. Perhaps she knew her husband was going to die. We don't know that. But yet, she still did what was right. And I don't know how much responsibility is on Bathsheba, but it's just interesting comparing them.
Well, we'll get to a place where I'll make my case for the level of responsibility on Bathsheba when we get to the 12th chapter. But what you're saying is true enough. Abigail, when she came to David, said, please don't do this thing that's wrong in the eyes of the Lord. We have no idea what Bathsheba may... Did I use the right names in the right order there? We have no idea what Bathsheba may or may not have said to David in acquiescing to him and going along with him in this thing. There are a couple of differences, though, in the stories of David and Abigail and David and Bathsheba, and one of them has to do with the position of David himself. David is an outlaw with a band of outlaws around him when he's in the desert of Judea, and Abigail comes to him and pleads with him to do the right thing. David is a king with all Israel subject to him and several foreign nations as well at the time when Bathsheba comes to him. And the suggestion in the story here is that Bathsheba is very young and naive, and I suspect that she was in awe of the king, which made her more vulnerable to his proposition than she might otherwise have been. She is never presented to us as a wicked woman. I appreciated that Richard, I think it was Richard, mentioned a couple of days ago that in the genealogy of Jesus, we have these five women mentioned, all of whom have something questionable in their background and in the stories associated with them. And Bathsheba is one of those five women who is mentioned in that context, someone who has a problematic background. And there's a reason why that's there in the genealogy of Jesus, and I think it's meant to reassure us and the fact that we can be a part of the family as well. There's more to it than that, but that's certainly part of it. But as we go through the story here, there is no emphasis here on what Bathsheba has said or done at all. We don't have any record of what she did say or didn't say in her encounter with David, but that David did indeed have a sexual relationship with her. Go ahead, Michael.
Although we often view Uriah as it's terrible that he was killed under these circumstances, and indeed it was, he was spared the grief that these circumstances would have brought him had he lived.
Yeah, I've seen too many of those instances where a man finds he has lost something that he counted sanctified and secure, and finding out that the very man that had done this is the king that he has served with loyalty for years. He was apparently one of David's followers in the desert before David ever became the actual king. Since he is numbered among the 30, he was one of those who was with David in the desert of Judea in the days when he was fleeing from Saul. This man had served David a long time. And it's obvious that he has utter respect and absolute loyalty to David, as did Joab as well. David found that Uriah had not gone home, and the reasons given in verse 11 of chapter 11, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and my Lord's men are encamped in the open fields. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing. This man is noble. He has a real sense of duty. He is doing his best to serve his king and to serve his people and to serve God. And this is the reward that he gets. David tried again to send him home. It didn't work out. And so David gave him a message. And the message to Joab was, make sure Uriah is in the worst of all possible places in the battle and doesn't get much support. And what did Joab do? He did exactly what David said. Now, that cost lives. It didn't just cost life. It cost lives. Because as we look at what Joab sent back by way of report, when the fighting became fierce and Uriah the Hittite was abandoned and he died there, in verse 18, Joab sent David a full account of the battle. He instructed the messenger, when you finish giving the king this account of the battle, the king's anger may flare up and he may ask you, why did you get so close to the city to fight? Because the battle had gone badly, you see. They had lost this battle. Why did you get so close to the city to fight? Didn't you know they would shoot arrows from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal-Sheth? Didn't a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall, so he died in Thebez, and etc.? If he asks you this, say to him also, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead. In other words, David is supposed to accept the losses because his intention of Uriah dying had been accomplished. This was not the loss of Uriah, this was the loss of a battle. And we don't know how many people, but Joab knew David would be displeased when he initially heard this, the turn of events, until he found out that it had accomplished the goal, that Uriah was now dead. And his secret was secure. How many people does it take to know a secret before it's not a secret anymore? Yeah, if two people know it, it's not a secret anymore. And how many people knew this? More than two. At least three. Probably more. In the household of David, when it said that he sent for her, David sent someone to find out about her. The man told David. And then verse 4, David sent messengers to get her. People know. The household of Kennedy. Well, at least you didn't say of Clinton. David sent back the message, tell Joab, don't worry about it. That's what happens in battle. The sword devours one as well as another. This is not the David that we admire. Well, this is the David that we admire. He's not Christ. He's not a sinless man. And this is a brutal dealing with the reality of the things that even good people do. When Jesus was called good at one time, you remember he said, why do you call me good? There's none good but God. That's right. That's right. God didn't cover up sin for anyone. David here is demonstrating the reality of how easily we fall into sin and how easily that process grows and becomes more and more difficult to cope with as we pile on error on top of error, trying to cover our tracks and keep from facing the inevitable reality that we need to change, that we need to acknowledge our wrong, that we need to pay a price in many cases. Deal with it and get it over with. I like the summation of this. We're told about how Bathsheba, after a period of mourning, appropriate period of mourning, is brought to David's house to become his wife. We already took note kind of facetiously, kind of lightly, that obviously David did not plan to take her as his wife in the course of events there, because he tried to make it seem that the child belonged to Uriah. He was letting willing to let her continue to be Uriah's wife. This was an overnight affair for him. But in an effort to make everything okay, he brought her to his house as his wife. I don't know what depth of love grew between them. He did care about her as the story progresses in the 12th chapter. He did care about her. Did good things come out of this bad event? Solomon? You know, I hear people justify so many things because something good came out of what they've done. Could God have provided a lineage that would lead to Christ through David without David taking Bathsheba? Well, of course he could have. The fact that a good thing is brought out of a bad event by God doesn't mean that it's okay, just do whatever you want, God will bring something good out of it. But people tend to think that way, tend to rationalize that way, tend to do the most hideous things because they figure, well, God can do something good about it. Consider the rest of the story. The ripples that flowed outward from this action or series of actions on David's part, and we'll talk a little bit about those.
I don't know if we ought to say that a good thing came out of it, it happened that way, but if it hadn't happened, the Lord would have arranged in a better way, I'm sure.
Exactly. If it hadn't happened this way, the Lord would have not only done it, but done it in a better way. Exactly. Go ahead, Dean. There is, of course, the implication in what Dean was saying there about how we should continue to meet with brethren and continue to worship God while we're trying to overcome sin. But there is at least the implication there of trying to overcome sin. Yeah, there are those who fall into sin and simply stay there. They don't do anything about it for whatever reason, whether they feel overwhelmed or helpless or feel that people will be judgmental of them or whatever it may be. There are those who try to go on as though nothing has happened, which is also not appropriate. I mentioned that question entered my mind when I looked at a connection between Psalm 21 and the account there in 1 Chronicles chapter 20 of David's victory and taking the crown and putting it on his own head. Was David just trying to pretend this never happened? You remember the story of, that guy whose name I can't think of, the big radio, Jimmy Swaggart, that's the guy. Remember the story of Jimmy Swaggart? This guy's getting up and giving all these sermons and all these exhortations and writing these books and putting out records, and it turns out he's been going and visiting prostitutes, you know, and it just kind of undermined his credibility just a little bit, don't you think? Well, I wanted to think that's not what's happening with David. I don't think that is what's happening with David when he writes Psalm 21. I think that indeed he has come to terms with the fact that he is a sinner, but he also has come to terms with the fact that God's goodness is still there. God still gives him victory over the Ammonites. God has not abandoned him. God has chastised him, but not abandoned him. Mike.
Musical creativity is also an often difficult thing to pin down.
Mm-hmm.
I recall the popular wintertime song, Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire, Jack Frost Nipping at My Nose, written in Los Angeles area, in the San Fernando Valley, where it does not snow.
Oh, does it?
And it was written in July, probably a degree, over 100 degrees temperature, but yet that person felt the inspiration for that particular song at that time.
There are some other songs we could point to in our songbooks where the circumstances very much gave rise to the song. It is well with my soul, being one of those kinds of songs. Amazing Grace being one of those kinds of songs. Well, let's go on a little bit here. Oh, go ahead, John.
As discouraging as this story is, in some ways, it's encouraging, if I can use that term, to me, to think that a man who is after God's own heart, even a man like that, can fall into, I mean, what seems to be the most abject wickedness. I mean, not only sleeps with another man's wife, but then he's able to actually pen these words, withdraw, so he can be struck down and die. I can't imagine doing something like that. But sometimes we fall into sin and we get real upset with ourselves. We don't want to forgive ourselves. We minimize God's grace. We think, you know, I must not be a godly person at all. How could I have done this? It's helped us out.
I agree. This does help us out to. And when you use the expression there, I can't imagine doing something like this. And I think that's part of the point of the story being here, is that, folks, we should be able to imagine ourselves doing something like this, because all of us are capable of doing things of this magnitude of wrong. We are capable of it. David is not a pervert. David is not someone who is in the habit of doing bad things. David is not someone who is mentally deficient. David is not someone who is not in control of his mental faculties, who is not aware of the power and grace and commandments and law of God. He is someone who has all these things lined up in his life, all these things in an appropriate place. And as we deal with ourselves, we need to understand that God's grace is sufficient for us, and we can carry on, we can reestablish a relationship with God if we have fallen into grievous error. And we need to also have the generosity toward our fellow believers who have done terrible things, that they too can be restored. At the end of chapter 11, I like the closing statement of that chapter: the thing David did had displeased the Lord. Well, there's an understatement for you, isn't it? It's an understatement that speaks volumes. The thing David did had displeased the Lord. And then we go on into the story of Nathan's approach to David, Nathan the prophet, and I applaud Nathan for his courage here. Nathan now is in the role of Abigail. Go ahead, Dave. Jay. By no means. By no means is this a contract to say, do whatever you want, it'll be okay. Not at all. Not at all. Richard.
David didn't get away with it.
He did not get away with it in any sense. He was forgiven. He was blessed. He didn't get away with it. There's a vast difference in those concepts. The Lord sent Nathan to David, and Nathan had the courage to go. Look at the message that Nathan is bringing to David. He had the courage to go. Is that because he trusts David or because he trusts God? Trust God. This is the time when you trust God, because you don't know if you can trust David or not, because of the choices that David has made, the things that he has done to cover his own sin. He's already killed. He has broken the 10th commandment, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. He's broken the 6th commandment. He's broken, well, what list of commandments has he broken? He has indeed committed adultery. He has indeed caused the death of an innocent man. He has murdered, in other words. He has stolen. He has taken what did not belong to him. And he has, of course, started all that by coveting what belonged to his neighbor. And he was very careful to find out. And it was literally his neighbor. A house close enough that he could see. But he has been careful to find out who this is, and it is a man who has been his neighbor and trusted ally for years in all kinds of arduous circumstances. Nathan came and he told a parable to David, and David did not recognize the story as a parable, and he reacted to the story that Nathan told. There were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food and drank from his cup and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. David burned with anger against this man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He must pay for that lamb 4 times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." And then the classic statement, Nathan said to David, "You are the man." People take things and put them in a box. And they carry on as if everything else is okay. And David here is not dealing with his own guilt. That doesn't mean it isn't there, but it's in a box. He's not dealing with it. And Nathan comes to him and confronts him, and as in the other occasion with Abigail, thank God David listened. Someone comes to him and says, you are absolutely wrong in what you have done, in the severest terms. You are condemned by your own mouth. And David could have reacted all kinds of ways, but how did David react? I have sinned against the Lord. This is why David, again, is called a man after God's heart. Not because he was incapable of doing great wrongs. We are all capable of doing great wrongs. But because he was capable of surrendering himself to the will of God, of acknowledging his wrong, of admitting his failures, of turning again to God. Jay.
Do you believe that Nathan brought this to light to David, showing him the whole picture? Just was David so involved in this that he didn't see the situation he was in? But I know, you know, we can find ourselves in a situation, someone points it out to us, and all of a sudden it's factual. You're right.
Nor indeed can we know with certainty every aspect of David's attitude. We can see what he wrote about his feelings when Nathan confronted him with his guilt. But there's a rationalization. Let me try this one out on you for size. There's a rationalization that righteous people sometimes go through that, you know, I can be more effective if people never know what I did wrong. If I can just get past this thing and people never know what I did or they forget about it, I can be more effective in my service than if I actually confront it, admit it, deal with it, and have people think less of me because they know that I've done wrong. I don't know that that kind of thing went through David's mind, but it seems to me something that does go through people's minds sometimes when they have sinned, and rather than doing as James encourages us to do and confess our faults to one another, the effort is to keep it hidden, because if someone knew about it, it would diminish my effectiveness. It would diminish my ability to deal with people. And is that the case? Is that the case, that it diminishes our effectiveness? In fact, it is just the opposite, because our humanness is apparent to people. All too often, people think, my sins, my problems, my other brethren don't have these problems. I'm the only one that has these failings. And that kind of an attitude makes us ever more vulnerable to other failures, because we don't confide in people, because we don't go and open up to a Samuel or a Jonathan or someone that we can trust that will help us come to terms with it, or a Nathan, someone that will help us come to terms with the need to change, with the need to make correction. And there is often a need to make correction, to have some sort of obvious change in order to deal with the things that have taken place. Well, I want to point out here, because there were some questions about the character of the sin and Bathsheba's role in it, as Nathan presents this to David, where does the fault lie? It utterly lies at David's door. Bathsheba is referred to as a ewe lamb. She is referred to as really a victim in this thing. Now, I'm not proposing to you that Bathsheba was without guilt for going along with David. That's not my point. But she is pictured here, really, in the course of the story, as a victim. He took the ewe lamb and served her up for dinner in the parable. And the guilt is laid in full measure at the door of the man who had the power, the man who had the control. Now, there are reasons for that, and there are a lot of things about this story that would be worth our time to talk about, but there are reasons for that that I want to call your attention to. I had hopes of going through and looking at the 22nd chapter of 2 Samuel, and we don't have time to do that, which David wrote after his victories and his kingdom had been made secure. I also had hopes, had intended to put a map up here that showed the extent of David's kingdom and to look at a couple of passages, Genesis 15, 18 to 21, Exodus 23, 31, that talked about the extent of the land of Israel, the dominion they would have, and how David is the one who brought that to completion in his victories over the Ammonites and over the Arameans and over the Philistines. David is the one who brought that to completion. It was only during the days of David and Solomon that Israel ever controlled the expansive territory that had been promised to Abraham initially and then promised to the Israelites again when they came out of the land of Egypt. And Psalm 22 talks about the ways that God had delivered David, had rescued him. But I do want to turn to 2 Samuel, not Psalm 22, but 2 Samuel 22. I want to turn to 2 Samuel 23 and look at what are described as the last words of David. These are the last words of David. 2 Samuel 23, verses 1 through 7. These are the last words of David, the oracle of David, son of Jesse, the oracle of the man exalted by the Most High, the man anointed by the God of Jacob, Israel's singer of songs. The Spirit of the Lord spoke through me. His word was on my tongue. The God of Israel spoke. The Rock of Israel said to me, when one rules over men in righteousness, when he rules in the fear of God, he is like the light of morning at sunrise on a cloudless morning, like the brightness after rain that brings the grass from the earth. And then David says, is not my house right with God? Has he not made with me an everlasting covenant, arranged and secured in every part? Will he not bring to fruition my salvation and grant me my every desire? I just want to look at the one part of that where David says, when one rules over men in righteousness, he is like the light of morning at sunrise. And we could go and look at the commandments relating to the king in the 17th chapter of Deuteronomy, where God lays out the groundwork. And one of the things that God says about the king of Israel in the law, before they ever had a king, is that he should not come to think of himself as being better than his brethren. It was very important in the Israelite concept of a king that the king uphold justice for the afflicted. That was his purpose. That was his job, was to secure justice for the oppressed and the afflicted. And that's exactly what Nathan comes to David and says, you didn't do. And David thinks initially that Nathan is coming to him with an actual case where justice has been thwarted because a rich man has taken advantage of a poor man. And it was the king's job to set that kind of thing right. That's what the king was to do. When we come to the New Testament and talk about Jesus Christ coming as the Son of David, that's the idea of the kingdom he is to establish. It is a kingdom of peace, a kingdom of justice, a kingdom of righteousness, where people are brought not down to the same level, but up to the same level, where the oppressed and the poor are delivered from the oppressor, delivered from their poverty, delivered from their sickness. The king, as the dispenser of justice, is a very important concept in the biblical idea of what a king is. And David had failed in that area when it came to Uriah the Hittite. He had taken advantage of his power. He had acted as though he were better than this man Uriah who had served him so loyally. He had taken what he wanted without concern for the other man. And in that episode, he had failed in terms of his kingship. One of the quotes we have about David, which I'll use as our closing comment for this class and this session, in spite of the fact I have tons of other things I'd like to say, in 1 Kings chapter 15 and verse 5, and this is on page 2 where we have descriptions of David in your notebook. 1 Kings 15 verse 5, David had done what was right in the eyes of the Lord and had not failed to keep any of the Lord's commands all the days of his life, except in the case of Uriah the Hittite. Now that's not saying this is the only sin David committed, but here David failed in his kingship. He failed to be what God wanted a king to be. He had not upheld justice. He had thwarted justice. And that is a high crime in the kingdom of God. God's people are to be fair in their dealings with other people. That's a basic premise. What does Jesus say? However you want to be treated, that's how you should treat other people. All right? That's a basic premise in the kingdom of God. That's a basic premise for one who will be a leader among God's people. And David had violated that principle to the utmost. Now, it is necessary to take note, because we haven't talked about it at all, that there were consequences from what David did with Bathsheba. Nathan said to him, because you have done this, and because people know about it, and because God's name is now being ridiculed among the Gentile nations, the sword will never depart from your house because of this. And hopefully we know how that goes. The next story we have is the story of David's son Ammon taking his daughter Tamar, his own half-sister, and raping her. And then that follows into the story of Absalom and how Absalom killed his brother Amnon. And then Absalom flees and eventually comes back to try and seize control of the kingdom. He takes some of David's concubines and has open sex with them in the sight of all Israel. David's house was a troubled house after this because of what he had done in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. Which brings us back, because I really wanted to remember this. I don't know how many of you know the name Ahithophel, but Ahithophel the Gilonite, who was the grandfather of Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite, taken by David. This man, Ahithophel the Gilonite, was one of David's most important counselors. He was considered a wise man whose word could always be trusted. Whatever he said to do, that was the thing to do. And one of the first things that Absalom did when he rebelled against David was to summon Ahithophel and invite him to join the conspiracy. And he did. And as David was leaving Jerusalem, word was brought to him also, Ahithophel the Gilonite is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David thought, oh, this is a disaster. With this man to advise him, we have real problems. And he had encouraged his friend Hushai the Archite to go back and try and offer contradictory advice and try and thwart the counsel of Ahithophel. But this was a matter of extreme concern to David. I bring that up just to make a point about how the sword would never pass from David's house. The most serious problems David had all came from people who were closely connected with him, people who were related to him, people that were within the circle, not just of his intimates, but within the circle of his family, including both Absalom and Absalom's counselor, Ahithophel the Gilonite, and many, many other examples. Did David get away with the sin with Bathsheba? God said, I forgive you and everything's fine. He didn't get away with anything. God forgave him. He was restored to a right relationship with God, but the consequences of his sin plagued him and broke his heart for the rest of his life and didn't even go away really in the days of his son Solomon. I'll leave that with you. Is there anything before we have a closing prayer? Okay, we'll have a closing prayer. I'll ask John Morris.
When he is by